This is Dr. Michael Bricky with Ageless Lifestyles Radio, cutting-edge thinking for being youthful at every age. On each program, I interview experts on what it takes to live longer, healthier, and happier. Today's show is Stress Illnesses, When Doctors Can't Find Anything Wrong, with Dr. David Clark. Every year, millions of people go to their doctors with very real illnesses. They see several specialists, go through endless of tests, only to be told, "We can't find anything wrong with you." Often the problem is caused by illnesses largely ignored by medical schools, namely stress illnesses. Today, Dr. David Clark shares with us how to recognize stress illnesses and what we can do about them. Dr. Clark, welcome.
Thank you, Michael. It's great to be with you.
Your career certainly has taken the road less traveled. How did you get from gastroenterology to being an expert in stress illness?
Well, it's funny how sometimes seemingly small events cause a big turn in your life. In my case, it all started with one patient that had baffled two universities in California, and all of her tests were entirely normal. I accidentally stumbled on the fact that she had undergone a severe stress 25 years in the past when she was a child, and I had no idea if that stress could possibly be connected to her severe illness, but there was a psychiatrist at UCLA where I was in my fellowship training years, and I knew that she was aware of these issues and asked her to get involved, and that was the last I ever saw of the patient. But a couple months later, I ran into Dr. Kaplan in an elevator and said, "How's that patient doing?" And it turned out that with a couple of months of counseling, she had cured the patient's illness. The patient had been on four different medications. She was no longer taking any of them, and she was entirely without her symptoms. And I just thought that was remarkable and asked Dr. Kaplan to explain to me and train me in how she did that, thinking it might be useful for 5 or 10 patients a year. Well, 7,500 patients later, I learned differently that this is an enormously common issue.
Was Dr. Kaplan a GI doctor or a psychiatrist?
Dr. Kaplan was a psychiatrist who had an interest in issues where stress can lead to physical symptoms in the body. And these are absolutely real physical symptoms, and they can affect not only the gastrointestinal system, but other systems literally from head to toe. And it turns out that they're remarkably common. In fact, some studies have shown up to 30 to 60% of people who go to a primary care doctor, this is what's responsible for their symptom. It's an epidemic.
And I see the American Psychological Association starting to wake up and say, hey, we ought to have a psychologist in every group family doctor's practices as well as a number of the specialists.
Yeah, that's turning out to be a very positive model for how to cope with this, that you go to see your doctor, they do the appropriate test, they examine you, they're not coming up with any visible explanation for your symptoms, but it turns out that stress can cause the same symptoms without any visible damage to the body, so there's nothing for the test to find. But if you have somebody with a mental health background or training right there in the primary care office, they can take over the care of the patient at that point. And it turns out with some fairly simple questions, you can find out what's going on, uncover the hidden stresses that most people don't recognize the power of in their lives. And the good news in all this is that once you uncover those problems, there's almost always effective treatment.
Mm-hmm. To get a real feel for this, could you give us a case history that illustrates a stress illness?
One of my favorite patients, a woman, when I walked in the room, she said, "Don't waste your time with me." And it turned out that she said that because she had been ill for 15 years. She had been hospitalized at a university in Seattle 4 times a year during those 15 years. With no diagnosis, no effective treatment. She'd had every test you can think of, many of them more than once. She'd gone through a 2-hour interview with a psychiatrist looking for mental health problems, and that turned out to be negative. So she was basically at the end of her rope and completely discouraged. But I started talking to her, and it turned out that she had been emotionally abused as a child. Her parents had divorced when she was 3 or 4 years old. Her mother hated her father. Mother had custody of her, and she displaced a lot of that anger onto her growing up when she remarried and had 2 more children. The new children got all the good stuff in the family, and my patient got the chores. And it turned out this emotional abuse was still going on in her life now when she was 50 years old, and there was enormous emotional tension in that relationship, and it turned out that the attacks of symptoms that this patient had were always connected with interactions with her mother. For example, many of her attacks occurred after she would talk to her mother on the phone. Many other attacks would take place when she was on her way driving to visit her mother, and she would pass through a little town that served as a trigger for her symptoms because it was the only time she went through that town was when she was on her way to visit her mother. So all that emotional tension was being expressed physically through her body. And this is represents a very common theme in my practice, childhood stress still being having an effect in the adult years, and she was a good example of that.
Why do you think the psychiatrist missed the real problem here?
It turns out to be very common that many psychiatrists and other mental health professionals, they just don't have experience with seeing people whose primary complaint is a physical symptom. You know, they're used to seeing people who have mental health problems, but you don't go to a psychiatrist to say, when your stomach is killing you, you don't go to see a psychiatrist and say, you've got to help me with my stomach pain. That's just not something that they are accustomed to seeing. So there's a particular set of questions and a certain mental point of view that you have to have when you're evaluating somebody with physical symptoms as opposed to mental symptoms, and many psychiatrists simply lack that experience.
I would think that most mental health professionals would be pretty familiar with how to treat lousy childhoods. I'm wondering if the physical presentation distracts them, and if the person just came in and said, I'm miserable, I'm depressed, they'd be far more likely to catch it.
That's absolutely right. They are perfectly happy and comfortable taking care of people who are depressed or anxious or who are dealing with a traumatic event in their life. But when it comes to making the connection with the physical symptoms and finding those linkages where the one leads to the other, some psychiatrists are outstanding at it. And Harriet Kaplan at UCLA, who was my mentor when I was starting out in this field 25 years ago, she was superb at this, and many mental health professionals are. But there are others where when it comes to physical symptoms, they back off and they're just not feeling as comfortable. It doesn't take much additional training to sort of graft onto what mental health professionals are already good at to get them to be comfortable in this area. And that's something that I'm working on these days is developing training programs for mental health professionals so that they can get comfortable with patients with this sort of problem.
You know, another thing that may have happened, we went from the extreme of Freudian psychology where everything was symbolic to now the emphasis is on cognitive behavioral psychology, and I'm a cognitive behavioral psychologist myself. Managed care loves it. It's very measurable, accountable. But sometimes with cognitive behavioral psychology, we forget to do the thorough history and look for the other possible things going on that lead to these kind of stress illnesses.
I agree with you completely on that. CBT is, it's particularly good, as you know, for anxiety disorders, and that's one of the conditions that can produce physical symptoms in my patients. But I also find that a very important component in evaluating and treating my patients is to look back at what they experienced when they were growing up. Did they come up in an environment that taught them things about themselves that aren't true? For example, did their self-esteem get knocked down to a low level? Did they come out of their childhood with the impression that they're a second-rate human being? Were they abused? Were there excessive adult responsibilities thrust upon them when they were growing up? Was there violence or alcoholism in the home? These kinds of experiences cause children to learn things that simply aren't true. They may learn that it's their job, for example, to solve other people's problems, to take care of everybody else in their environment. They may have to be very vigilant about details in their environment, and they oftentimes become perfectionists or very, very detail-oriented. So these kinds of experiences I find that I need to lean into a little bit in order to understand the person that I'm trying to take care of.
I think people normally think of physical abuse, sexual abuse, alcoholism. Yeah, of course. But you also talk a lot about people who had perfectionistic parents. You just couldn't do enough for them, or people who were pushed into parenting their parents or parenting their siblings, and they grow up being super responsible perfectionist, and so they come to the doctor, couldn't imagine anything psychologically wrong with them, and they don't impress the doctors as anything psychologically wrong with them. And I think we really miss those people.
You're absolutely right. The childhood experiences that can have a negative impact on an adult can sometimes be very subtle. And sometimes when I ask people, what was it like when you were growing up? And they'll say, oh, you know, really nothing bad. It was really fine. But then you have to probe a little bit more and you find out that things were not so fine. One of my patients was a champion springboard diver, and she did her sport before school, after school, and on weekends. And it was kind of like her job. She never really had a chance to play like most other children. And when children are playing, they're learning an essential human skill, which is the skill of self-care. And so as an adult, she never really took time for herself. She had a full-time job. She had a husband and two younger children to take care of. She had her household to manage. And she was also, as a volunteer effort, she was coaching children in diving, her own children and others. She was driving them to out-of-state competitions. She was on the swim club board of directors. Nowhere in her life was there any space for herself, because she'd always been, throughout her life, focused on what other people needed from her. And she just finally hit the wall, and she ended up in the emergency room needing a powerful narcotic to relieve her stomach pain. So this was a good example of a very subtle situation in her childhood that deprived her of just simply learning how to take care of herself.
Yeah, it looks like a model life. And one of the solutions that you would told her was, you need to set aside time for yourself. You need to play.
And that prescription turns out to be the only thing that she needed to get relief from her stomach pains. But it turned out to be surprisingly difficult when you, and it does for most of my patients who fall into this category, when you've never learned how to do self-care, it can be a challenge to learn it in the middle of your life. And it takes most of my patients several months. And they often feel very guilty, and they also very frequently look at me when I recommend them taking 4 or 5 hours a week out of the house for pure self-indulgence time. They'll look at me and they'll say, what am I going to do with that time? Because they just simply don't have any experience with that.
Dr. Clark, do you think of yourself more as Lieutenant Columbo or Sherlock Holmes?
You know, I'm a big admirer of Sherlock Holmes, and there was another mentor of mine who was a psychologist in Cambridge, Massachusetts, who was just simply remarkable at sitting down with a person she'd never met before and just listening to that person and hearing all kinds of little clues in what the person was saying and how they were dressed and how they conducted themselves, and could draw really remarkable conclusions about what it was like to be that person based on very little information, it seemed to me at the time. And Sherlock Holmes was great at doing the same thing. He'd pick out all kinds of little clues about a person, and really is helpful to have that ability when you're meeting brand new people for the first time and trying to figure out, you know, who is this person? What is it really like to live inside their body and to be them? And you really, in many cases, especially the more subtle ones, you really need to be able to do that to figure out what's going on.
One of the things I kept reading in your book, They Can't Find Anything Wrong, is a lot of anniversary effects, perhaps anniversary of a sibling's death or a parent's death or a parent leaving or divorcing. Are there good questions for getting at those kinds of issues?
One of the questions that I commonly ask is, did anything stressful happen to you right before your symptoms began? And that one will oftentimes bring things up. There was one of my patients who had been sexually assaulted by 3 men 13 years in the past. She had been ill for 3 weeks, and I asked her, did anything happen to you right before you became ill? And it turned out she had gone to a therapist to talk about this sexual assault, and the very first time she went to the therapist was the day before she became ill, and there was some things that happened during the visit with the therapist that triggered her illness. That's a common thing. Another patient of mine was a psychologist whose father had been murdered, and her physical symptoms began on the 5th anniversary of his murder. So I look for that as well, particularly in patients where there's been a trauma in the past.
Mm-hmm. I was fascinated by the one where every time the woman got close to where her mother lived, which was in another state, she started getting sick?
There was a woman who, and this was a good example too, that it's not always the things that we usually think of as being traumatic. For this woman who had never had a good relationship with her mother, I may be thinking of a different patient than the one you are, but there was a woman who had not had a good relationship with her mother. Mother died. She went back to the family homestead, was going through the effects in the household, and came across a letter in the family Bible written by her mother, addressed to her, and containing, among other things, a list of 10 reasons why I hate you. You know, horrible thing to have read, and tore it up, burned it in the fireplace, tried to forget she'd ever seen it. But the next time she was back in her hometown where the mother had lived, it triggered an episode of chest pain, and the chest pains persisted even after she came back home. So that was an example, two examples there. One of the fact that the traumatic event was not a car accident or a sexual assault. It was reading this letter. And the other was the geographic trigger.
You encourage people to do a stress inventory. Can you describe that for us?
I mean, people who are trying to figure out what might be going on, a really useful technique is to simply sit down and make a list of everything in your life that is causing stress or worry, nervousness, anxiety, fear, anger. Write all those things down. And I encourage people to keep that list with them as they go about their day and their week, and add to the list as new ideas occur to them. And then when they feel like they have a fairly complete accounting of all the things that they're coping with, first of all, they may be surprised by how much winds up on that list. But second of all, they can look at it and they can try to find a few items on the list, maybe just two or three, that they can do something about. Because very often, if you can fix a couple items on that list, you may find that your physical symptoms or your general stress level or your fatigue or your tension level start to improve. And if that happens, then you've got really good circumstantial evidence that you're on the right track as far as where these problems are coming from.
And I really like your idea of keep adding to it, because the initial time you sit down, you may be well defended mentally against the traumas or bad events from the past, and they may start leaking out as you think about it in the back of your mind over time.
Past events, I mean, that's especially important, because when you're growing up in a difficult environment, you tend to take your emotional reaction to what's going on and to stuff it somewhere in the back of your head. And difficult environments may not tolerate emotional expression by children very well, and children quickly pick up on that. And so they're still having those emotional reactions, but they've got to do something with it other than express it. And they get really good at stuffing things into a box somewhere in the back of their head. And so when they're adults and they look back, they may not necessarily perceive how bad things were. So one of the techniques that I recommend to people that's been very useful in my practice is for people to imagine what it would be like for a child that they care about, either their own child or somebody else's, to grow up in that same environment and they have to watch it happening. Would it be emotional to be watching something like that? And that frequently clues people into just how much difficulty they really had to overcome.
Exactly. And I see people sometimes saying, this person feels they're unworthy, and of course, it's often a super responsible person. How could they have such a crazy, stupid idea? And I think they don't realize that when you're a child, you don't have the rational thinking processes that adults do, and so these ideas get locked in, and then just like a skill like driving, they become part of you that you don't think about anymore, and you carry them into adulthood.
And the consequences of that are really significant. One of the common ones is that it leads you into relationships with people that tend to be negative. You know, if you grew up with the message over and over and over again that you're a second-rate human being, it's only natural that you're going to fall into relationships as an adult that are consistent with that view of yourself. And many of my patients have become involved with people who tried to control them or who abused them or who were very, very needy or irresponsible. And I call these the bad partners, and not unusual to have several of them in the early years of your life.
And, of course, we see a lot of people from alcoholic families marrying alcoholics. It's a familiar script.
And it makes perfect sense because you've basically grown up in an environment that has taught you things about yourself that are not true. It's taught you that you need to be responsible and fix the problems, that you are a second-rate person, that you don't deserve any better than this, that you don't deserve somebody who cares about you as much as you care about them. And human beings are learning creatures. One of the things that we're best at is taking in information and processing it. But the problem comes when we are given information as very young people about ourselves that isn't true. And we, even though it's not true, we can't see that when we're 5 years old. So we just absorb those lessons before we have a chance to do anything about it.
Do you see patterns with certain kinds of physical illnesses going with certain patterns of stress or childhood problems? For example, do you see it with heartburn and GERD?
You know, that's one of the fascinating unanswered questions about this whole field is, why does a particular patient develop a particular symptom in connection with a particular stress? And I have no answer to that. The variety of symptoms that people can get and the variety of stresses that they've suffered from, there seems to be almost no rhyme or reason to why one is connected to another. But people can get headaches, dizziness, ringing in the ears, lump in the throat, problems with the joint at the angle of the jaw called the TMJ joint, difficulty breathing, all kinds of gastrointestinal problems, which is how I got into it, pain almost anywhere, numbness and tingling of the skin, itching of the skin. I mean, the list of symptoms is virtually endless, and I've seen them connected with virtually any kind of stress. So there's something going on in the brain that we're probably going to understand a lot better 100 years from now. We're beginning to unlock some of this with functional MRI imaging, among other things, but we're a long way from understanding the physiology of those connections.
Is it that there hasn't been much research done, or is it that the research just isn't finding any patterns?
I think it's more that the research is just beginning. We just haven't had the tools that would enable us to unravel this enormously complex condition. But I can inform your listeners of one very fascinating study that showed that when people were experiencing pain, a limited amount of pain in a research setting that was inflicted on volunteer subjects, it turned out that the subjects who had been through a difficult or traumatic childhood, the pain was processed using different circuits in the brain than it was in people who had grown up in happier homes. Just a fascinating finding that pain signals were actually processed differently if you had grown up in a dysfunctional environment.
Something I'm a little unclear about, you talk about five different kinds of stress illnesses. We've been talking about childhood ones where the stress occurred in the childhood. You also talk about current stress, traumatic stress, depression, and anxiety. I would think the other four are ones that are pretty familiar territory for clinicians. Are you just trying to be comprehensive, or are you saying that there are a lot of unique things about these other four that we haven't addressed?
Well, the unique thing is when these patients come in to see the doctor, they come in and they say, I've got this and such physical symptom. They don't come in and say, I feel anxious or I feel depressed or I went through a trauma some time ago or I'm overwhelmed in my current life. Or they come in and they say, my stomach hurts or my chest hurts or I'm having a shortness of breath or my voice is changing. You know, any of these symptoms that I mentioned earlier, that's what they go into the doctor for. That's what the doctor focuses in on and begins doing their diagnostic evaluation. And when the tests are normal, unfortunately, most physicians don't have any formal training in what to do next. So they're kind of at a loss, and they may refer to a specialist or they may order more tests. But very frequently, the specialist, you know, has also no formal training in what to look for. And in study after study, for example, has shown that in depression, the diagnosis is missed. Diagnosis of depression is not made by about two-thirds of the cases. And this is very frequently because the way it shows up in a person's life is as a physical symptom. And if you don't ask the specific questions, you don't find it.
Once they figure out, if they do figure out, that it's depression, is it usually pretty well treated then?
Absolutely, and that's the really good news about all of this that we're talking about here this morning. Once you uncover the hidden stress, there's almost always effective treatment. My patient who was having these terrible attacks of nausea, vomiting, and dizziness that she was hospitalized for 60 times over 15 years, once we uncovered the connections with the emotional abuse from her mother, her illness melted away. I mean, that was a dramatic turnaround, but basically in an hour, she was cured. That's a little faster than a lot of patients, certainly, and I have others that are needing years of mental health therapy before they make substantial progress. But generally speaking, we can get people on the pathway toward recovery fairly quickly.
And I just underscore, you weren't intending this, but you're not saying it's the Freudian concept of once you understand what the problem is, it's solved. It's once you understand what the problem is, there are a lot of good treatments that are very effective for it.
Absolutely, yes. And you can get yourself on the pathway toward making substantial progress. And you may still have some mental health issues to work on, but very often the physical symptoms that brought you to medical attention in the first place can improve significantly in a short period of time.
We're talking with Dr. David D. Clark, author of They Can't Find Anything Wrong, Seven Keys to Understanding, Treating, and Healing Stress Illness. And I also note that your website says all of the royalties from the book go for education.
Yes, I'm going to actually be retiring from my practice in a couple of months, and what I've been doing is traveling the country teaching healthcare professionals what to look for so that they can recognize this illness in their own practices.
Are you also doing seminars for the general public or just healthcare professionals?
Yes, I do them for the general public as well, and people who are interested in that can contact me through the website, stressillness.com. I've done quite a few lectures for the public and giving people insight into this so that they can understand their own issues, usually fairly readily.
Website again is stressillness.com. Did you coin the term stress illness?
You know, that's an interesting question. I did coin that term. I was looking for something that would make sense to people. It's simple. It lets people know where the problem is really coming from. And I like it especially because it begs the question that if stress is causing the illness, what's the stress? And that's the key, is if you can uncover that hidden stress, the one that, you know, people frequently don't recognize in themselves, then that leads directly to effective treatments. There must be a dozen or two synonyms for this condition that have been used down through the millennia of medical history, but this one is simple and straightforward, and I use it a lot, particularly in lecturing the public.
Do you see the American Medical Association or physicians in general catching on to this? What happens next to really get the message out besides the seminars that you do?
I'm working with a national group that met in Michigan just a couple of months ago to develop uniform criteria for training and accrediting healthcare and mental health professionals in doing this work. I think the reason that it's going to catch on is that once people understand how really straightforward this is, they're going to adopt it. They already are. I mean, talks that I give have been very enthusiastically received. But the other reason I think it's going to be popular is that it's extremely cost-effective. I mean, you think about that woman with her 15 years of suffering and all of the medical dollars that were expended during 60 hospital admissions, and yet she could be essentially relieved of her symptoms with a one-hour conversation. You know, that's a source of tremendous savings in healthcare dollars, and I think that's going to be, once people recognize that, it's going to be a strong basis for adopting this.
Sounds like you're not going to get the pharmaceutical companies to sponsor your seminars.
Well, on the contrary, when you think about the fact that two-thirds of patients with depression, the diagnosis is not made, and that many of those patients could benefit from medication appropriately, you know, not all of them, certainly. I don't prescribe antidepressants for all of my patients, but, you know, if you've got two-thirds of people suffering from depression out there who are not getting appropriate diagnosis and treatment, you know, that's something that would get the attention of a pharmaceutical company, certainly.
Is there any other way that the message is getting out and we're getting, particularly primary care physicians, more alert to this? I certainly find that with depression, most family docs are very comfortable with antidepressants, you're saying they're just missing that it is depression in the first place.
Yes, because the patient doesn't come in and say, you know, I feel like my life is no longer worth living, I'm feeling very down. And, you know, certainly many patients do come into the doctor saying that, but the majority of patients, at least in my practice, when I ask them, do you feel depressed? They say no. They say, you know, they may say they feel frustrated or exasperated or at the end of their rope with their physical symptom, but they're actually denying that they feel depressed. But when you go through the list of other potential depression symptoms, difficulty sleeping, fatigue, losing interest in activities they used to enjoy, crying for no obvious reason, you know, when you run through that list of questions with people, then you start getting positive responses to that, and you can see that behind the physical symptom that they came into you for are these underlying issues. And once, you know, we teach primary care clinicians about that, which is, you know, very straightforward to do, then they know to look for it, and they'll know not to stop when their diagnostic tests are normal.
Getting to the what to do about this, first of all, I was fascinated with the I deserve better stage. Can you tell us about that?
This is in people who were mistreated as children, who grew up in abusive or otherwise dysfunctional environments that knocked their self-esteem down. And when they've become adults and they've moved away from that environment, their self-esteem begins to improve. Many times their survival of those early environments has led them to be very compassionate towards others, to be very detail-oriented, to be very hard-working, and the world at large really loves people like that, and they begin to get a lot of positive feedback and support from the world in general, and their self-esteem begins to improve and to sort of pick itself up off the floor that it was in when they were living in that early home environment. And eventually, they get to the point where they recognize that they deserve to be treated just as well as anybody else. And they may be in a bad relationship at home or at work, but they recognize one day, hey, you know, I deserve better. I deserve to be treated just as well as anybody else. And this is a huge mental shift, and it's a critically important stage in a person's recovery from a dysfunctional childhood. And the difficulty in the short term is that making such a big shift can be very stressful because all of a sudden you're looking at yourself differently and also everybody in your life differently, including your parents and other people you may have grown up with. So temporarily it may increase your stress, and very often people become physically symptomatic at that point.
And the family members may be unhappy that you're not the patsy anymore who does whatever they ask you to do.
Yeah, especially if you've got a controlling spouse and all of a sudden you decide, hey, I deserve better than to be treated this way. I deserve to be in a relationship where I receive back everything that I give to that relationship. And it can put a lot of pressure on a bad marriage.
So this is a point where I often do some assertiveness training to try to get them to have balance in taking care of others and appreciating others' needs, but also appreciating their own needs and how to communicate that well.
Very, very useful. And I also will point out to people that a hero in our society is somebody who has overcome a difficult emotional or physical challenge for a good cause. And my patients who have been childhood stress survivors, they've done exactly that. They've done a heroic thing. They have survived the moral equivalent of being born on the far side of Mount Everest, and they've had to sort of climb up and over that mountain to get to be an adult. And they should look at that experience as something positive that they've overcome, something that they have survived, and that they should look at themselves with pride for having done that. And that's also a 180-degree shift in self-image, but it serves as a tremendous foundation for further improvements to come.
So after being Sherlock Holmes, you become the Wizard of Oz and give them a medal for courage or whatever they achieved.
Absolutely. That's a great analogy, but I'll frequently take my business card and I'll write the person's name on it, and I'll say, Michael is a hero, or Janine is a hero, an exclamation point, and I'll ask them to tape that to their bathroom mirror where they'll see it every day, or maybe keep it in their wallet or their purse as a constant reminder of what they've overcome and how they should look at themselves as a human being. And it makes a tremendous difference. I have people, I had somebody who came up to me in the shopping mall the other day, remembered me from a few years back, opened up her purse and took out the little card that I had written for her 3 or 4 years ago. So these are very, very useful.
We'll get back to Dr. Clark in just a moment. Historically, psychologists have focused on fixing what's wrong with you. From almost 40 years of clinical experience, frankly, I'm very good at that, but what I enjoy doing most is helping successful people be even more successful and even healthier. Success in life calls for being crystal clear about who you are, what you want, and how you're going to achieve it. Just as athletes use coaches to achieve their full potential, my coaching can help you achieve your full potential. If you have goals and you're having difficulty achieving them, or you're interested in life makeover coaching to develop a comprehensive plan for your life, give me a call and I'll see if I can help you. For therapy issues like Dr. Clark described, I meet with people in person. Coaching, however, works very well by phone. The phone number is on all my websites, and further information about my coaching is at drbrickey.com, drbrickey.com, or you can go to notaging.com, notaging.com. And now back to Dr. Clark. And you often have people write letters.
Very also a technique that I found, you know, mostly through trial and error with 7 or 8,000 patients. I've tried all kinds of things, and one of the ones that is really proved its worth in my practice is for a childhood stress survivor to write a letter to the person or persons who mistreated them when they were growing up. Not to mail it, generally. I mean, I would say 99% of them are never mailed, but just to write it, to get your deepest thoughts and emotions about the individual or individuals down on a piece of paper, because it turns out that the act of writing is just magic in its ability to pull ideas and emotions out of your head that you may only be half aware of, and it basically converts the physical expression of those emotions, which is what's producing the symptoms that bring people to my office. It converts them into verbal expression, and very often the more people put down on a piece of paper, the less there is that goes into their body and causes illness.
Well, they don't mail them. What do you have them do with those, or do they eventually tear them up?
That I leave as an individual decision. If they want to mail it, they can, but I make it very clear that it's not part of the therapeutic value of the letter writing to mail it. And people make up their own decisions about what to do with them. One of my patients who insisted she was only going to write 2 paragraphs to her father, well, she wound up with 9 or 10 single-space pages, and she keeps it in a locked desk drawer in her office. Another one of my patients had, when she was 17, they were at a family picnic on the California coast, and her father just inexplicably got up from the picnic, walked to the edge of a cliff, and kept going, and his body was never found. And she went back to the seashore below that cliff with the letter that she'd written to him, put it in a small wooden boat, and pushed it out into the ocean. Another one of my patients took the letter, and you know, her father was deceased, and she burned it with the idea that the smoke was somehow going to carry her word to him. It's a very emotional thing for people, and I leave it to their own decision about what to do with the letters, because that's what's going to be the most meaningful.
Backing up a bit, you say the first step is to consider stress as a possible cause. We've been talking about how a lot of people never would have dreamed of that stomach pain or that backache or those headaches as being from stress, and their doctors miss it too. When does a patient say, gee, the tests are coming back negative, it's time for me to maybe check with a mental health professional or something to see if maybe it's stress?
It's a sort of a combination of things. I'll usually bring up stress as a possibility, even on my initial encounter with a patient, assuming there's not an obvious physical or visible explanation for their illness. I'll usually bring it up just to indicate that I'm trying to cover all the possibilities for what may be responsible for their symptoms and to get people thinking about it. And if we uncover some stresses, I'll ask people to do some work on those issues. At the same time, I'm ordering blood tests and maybe an endoscopy test or in some cases a CAT scan. We'll do all of those things simultaneously. And then when they come back for their follow-up visit, we'll look over the results of all the tests. And we'll also look at the results of the work they've done on the stress issues. And if we find that, number one, the tests are all normal, and number two, that their physical symptoms are starting to improve with the work they're doing on the stress issues, then that gives us some good circumstantial evidence that we're on the right track. And maybe we don't have to be quite so aggressive with ordering more tests if we see that the person is making progress, getting better with their work on stress. So that's kind of a general model for how I approach things, and it enables me to perhaps not have to do quite so many tests as I would otherwise.
So a good rule of thumb might be one good comprehensive workup that finds nothing, should at least simultaneously search for stress causes.
Yes, and you know, if you're making progress, you know, you've uncovered the stress, you've worked on it, and you find that the person is getting better, that's a good indication that you're on the right track. But I always, you know, bear in mind that just because you're making progress doesn't mean that you've found the answer. You can't be conclusive about the diagnosis of stress illness basically until the symptoms have all gone away. If you cure the patient and relieve all their physical symptoms, that's when you can safely conclude that your diagnosis was correct.
So your process, the first two steps are really diagnostic. We had considering stress as a possible cause, and then the second diagnostic step is trying to make the connections, find the sources for the problems.
Yes, looking into each of the five different kinds of stress that you mentioned earlier to see, you know, are they active in a particular person's life? And if they are, and there may be more than one at a time, do what you can to try to relieve those, you know, the techniques that I've developed over the last couple of decades, and use those. And then if the person is improving, if their symptoms are responding, that gives you some confidence to keep going in that direction.
Your last step is one that I particularly love, and that is, you say, become the person you always wanted to be, or as I would phrase it, know what you want, not just what you don't want. How'd you come up with that one?
What I found with particularly my childhood stress survivors is that they had learned things from their early environment about themselves that weren't true. I mean, as I mentioned earlier, we are learning creatures, and we absorb information from the moment we're born and even before we're born about the world around us, but also we absorb information about who we are as people and what we're good at and what we're not good at. And unfortunately, we have the ability to learn things about ourselves that are not true if we happen to find ourselves in a dysfunctional environment. And it's only by peeling away those false learnings about ourselves that we can achieve our potential as human beings, that we can become the people that we were meant to be had we grown up in an environment that had given us an accurate picture of our strengths and weaknesses. So that's the ultimate goal of all this, is to get rid of or to at least minimize the impact of these five hidden, unrecognized stresses in our lives so that we can come as close as possible to achieving our potential as human beings.
Another thing I like about Become the Person You Always Wanted to Be, support groups can be just enormously helpful. Adult children of alcoholics and AA and many, many other support groups. But sometimes people get stuck in that identity, and 10 years later, they're still going to ACOA meetings just as a member, not as a leader. And this dictum prompts you to say, hey, this should be an intermediate part of the healing process that I should eventually graduate from.
And I try to emphasize that with my patients, that it should be considered as a tool toward gaining health, toward gaining accurate perspective on yourself, but it should definitely not be considered an end of itself. I frequently send my patients to a class for adult children of dysfunctional families, but it's time limited. It was 2 hours a week for 8 weeks, and then it ends, so that you know that you have to get as much as possible from that period of time, and it really focuses people. It's not an unending thing that they can go on to for years, and I think that's a more valuable model.
I don't know why I've never thought of it, but I love that idea of prescribing a certain amount of time.
Personal time, essential for many of my patients. I have so many that, particularly those that grew up in environments where they had excessive responsibilities or where they were distracted from paying attention to themselves so that they never really got a chance to play as children. It's an essential human skill to be able to do self-care, to be able to essentially just play. And if you don't have that, sooner or later it's going to catch up with you and you're going to hit the wall. So it's a common prescription for me to send people off every week on a regular basis for 4 or 5 hours of self-indulgence. I want people to achieve the same level of joy as a four-year-old with finger paints. That four-year-old doesn't care how many pictures per hour they produce. They don't care about the quality of the work or who sees it. They just know they're having a blast. And everybody needs that in their life. Me personally, I go play indoor soccer every week. You know, after trying to be kind and compassionate to my patients, it's nice to go out there and kick something. And that is my personal stress relief. And everybody needs that. And so many of my patients don't have it.
This is a wonderful paradox. You get the super conscientious, responsible people who wouldn't dream of taking time for themselves, but if the doctor whips out a prescription pad and puts it on the pad, then you got to do it.
Yeah, I absolutely do that. I mean, with my patients who are a little reluctant, I'll take out the prescription pad, I'll write these words, you know, just as you said, on the pad and hand it to them. It's something that they can show their spouse or their children. Say, doctor says, I got to do this, so off they go. And it's basically a matter of putting yourself on the list of people you take care of. It's nothing more than that.
You know, one I didn't see on your list, I would encourage massage a lot, both as a wonderful way of relaxing and also a kind of a time for yourself.
Massage is good. Yoga, meditation, those are all valuable ways of taking care of yourself. I have a list on page 114 of the book, in fact, just to give some people ideas of things they could do for their self-care activity. But it really comes down to trial and error. People just have to go out and try anything, really, and see how it goes. Because even if it doesn't work out, you are teaching yourself about yourself every time you do that. And gradually, over time, you'll get better and better at it. I tell my patients it's like I'm sending them off to learn how to ride a bicycle for the first time. They're not going to get it right initially, but if they keep at it, if they're persistent, their skill level is going to improve steadily.
I'm surprised that doctors are missing the PTSD, the post-traumatic stress disorder. That would seem to be a pretty dramatic presentation.
It is dramatic, but sometimes the trauma has occurred years in the past, and the patient doesn't recognize that it's still having an impact. And so it's one of those stresses that you just have to ask for. I mean, this whole area of medicine, it's shocking and embarrassing as a medical professional that we're not finding these things in our patients on a routine basis, because the questions are really not all that difficult. I mean, with trauma, you just say, have you been through a horrifying or terrifying event at some time in your life? I mean, how difficult is that to ask?
Mm-hmm.
And when you do, you very frequently find that people have had these events in their life, and it's frequently not that difficult to find the connection. The patient I mentioned earlier, her sexual assault had taken place 13 years ago. Her symptoms had only started 3 weeks ago, but it was the very day after she had gone to a therapist for the very first time to talk about the assault. And what happened in that visit, which I didn't mention earlier, was the therapist asked her to close her eyes and take herself back to the night of the assault. And within 60 seconds, she vomited all over his carpet. She didn't even have time to grab a wastebasket. So it was clear that it was still having an enormous impact on her psychologically. The very next morning, she wakes up with this terrible pain up near her gallbladder, and it was unrelenting for the 3 weeks after that. But very easy to ask about trauma, but we're not teaching our healthcare professionals, at least our physicians, how to do this.
You could even add a few questions on the history form that patients fill out in the waiting room.
Yeah, very straightforward. You know, a couple of questions about the anxiety disorders as well. We haven't spent a lot of time talking about that, but that's also a key is, are you feeling tense, anxious, nervous, worried, out of proportion to any reason for those feelings to be there? You know, not a difficult question to have on your pre-screening questionnaire and can clue you into a lot of symptoms that people have.
Finally, I wanted to ask you about your publisher, Sentient Publications. It looks like a very unusual, very interesting publisher. They said they only do 12 books a year, and they try to make it very unique books. Was that a unique experience for you?
Yes, it's a small publisher. When the manuscript was being circulated, I was in discussions with a very large, well-known publisher in New York City, but they had some ideas about things that they wanted to change to make the book more, quote-unquote, marketable, but I was uncomfortable with the changes, and this small publisher in Colorado loved the book just the way it was, and I just felt very comfortable working with her.
Wonderful. We're talking with Dr. David Clark, who is the author of They Can't Find Anything Wrong, 7 Keys to Understanding, Treating, and Healing Stress Illnesses, a fascinating read and a very helpful book. It's only $16.95, and that's the retail price. You may get it cheaper on Amazon or something. Dr. Clark does seminars for both healthcare professionals and the public. The website is stressillness.com. That's stressillness.com. Anything else you want to add, Dr. Clark?
Well, I'd just like to say that this condition is one that is quite straightforward to uncover. The book itself basically consists of 4 dozen stories that are designed to illustrate the spectrum of different stresses that can cause these problems, and usually one or more of those stories will resonate for the reader and lead them directly into treatment techniques that have helped thousands of my patients.
And it's written in a lay language, very readable.
Yes, just for the general public.
Dr. Clark, thank you so much. I love what you're doing, and it's just enormously needed.
Well, thank you, Michael. I really appreciate being on your program today and your very thoughtful questions.
Commentary. The problem isn't that therapists don't know how to deal with childhood issues, stress, PTSD, depression, and anxiety. The problem is that patients with stress illnesses go to their physicians or emergency rooms with real illnesses. The physicians focus on physical causes and have little training in psychological causes. When the tests find nothing, most keep looking or refer to a specialist. Few of these patients would go directly to a psychologist, but even if they did, many psychologists, since they haven't had training in dealing with patients that primarily present physical illnesses, would be distracted or intimidated by the physical illnesses. Thus, the patients go on a wild goose chase, and the problems persist for years, possibly even a lifetime. I would try to come up with a statistic like half of all doctor visits are stress-related, but that's an artificial statistic, as stress and physical causes are usually co-conspirators in an illness. The good news is that most psychologists and mental health professionals are very familiar with how to treat stress illnesses, including those arising from lousy childhoods or trauma. Dr. Clark's book, They Can't Find Anything Wrong, and the training he is doing is sorely needed. It would help if doctors put some stress-related questions on their screening histories. Medicine is very protocol-driven. If the medical decision tree, say, refer to a psychologist or other qualified mental health professional when the usual test for presenting problems aren't finding something wrong, many of these patients would get the help they need. The ultimate solution would be to have a psychologist in every primary care physician's office, and many specialist offices as well. The doctor could walk over and introduce the patient to the psychologist or mental health professional and make an appointment. That can be especially important to grease the path, since many of these patients are probably reluctant to see their illnesses as having a psychological cause. I know that the American Psychological Association is increasingly advocating for psychologists to be in primary care physicians' offices. the Ageless Lifestyle show we did with cardiologist Dr. Joel Ochner and cardiopsychologist Dr. Jeremy Corafine, provides an excellent illustration of how this can work in a specialty practice as well. When children grow up in dysfunctional families, they often make decisions at a very young age about what script they're going to follow. Some act out, some develop abysmal self-esteem and become physical or emotional punching bags, some turn to alcohol or drugs, some become junior social workers trying to please everyone and avoid conflict or strife. Some have to sacrifice their childhoods and parent the parents or parent the sibs. Many try to cope by being perfect. Thus, many patients whose stress illnesses had childhood origins seem so responsible and effective that few suspect anything is wrong psychologically. To recap the solution that Dr. Clark recommends, the first two steps are diagnostic. First, consider stress as a possible cause, and second, search for the sources and connections. Creating a stress inventory and periodically adding to the list can help. Then it is on to seeking whatever solution or therapy would be most helpful. Some of the strategies that Dr. Clark especially likes include giving yourself permission to play, scheduling time for yourself, writing letters, observing children and imagining them experiencing the stresses, time-limited support groups, and becoming the person you always wanted to be. I especially like becoming the person you always wanted to be, as the goal shouldn't be just the absence of headaches and backaches and stomach aches and the like, but having a wonderful life. Dr. Clark's fascinating book is in layman's language. It's very readable and a bargain at only $16.95. Baby steps. I always try to leave you with a little tweak in your behavior or lifestyle that'll help you with our goal of living longer and healthier and happier. And today's baby step is to take that stress inventory that Dr. Clark talked about. It's simply a matter of getting a little piece of paper or making a list of everything that causes you fear, worry, anxiety, tension, anger, or emotional pain. You keep the list with you for a while. As new stressors dawn on you, add them to the list. Then highlight your top three stressors and focus on what you can do to help with those stresses. It's that simple. I'd love to get your emails. Send your feedback to radio@agelesslifestyles.com. That's radio@agelesslifestyles.com. And for information on my anti-aging books, anti-aging hypnosis CDs, personal coaching, and speaking services, you can just log on to notaging.com, notaging.com. Recent shows are always on webtalkradio.net, and all shows are archived on agelesslifestyles.com. This is your anti-aging psychologist, Dr. Michael Bricky, on webtalkradio.net and agelesslifestyles.com. Thanking you for joining us on our quest to live longer, healthier, and happier.